Hello, it's Wednesday, the 3rd of February. I'm Gary Bauerman from Check-In Asia. On this week's show, we are super excited to be talking all things aviation and airlines in ASEAN with Michelle D, Manager Global Affairs and Policy at Air Asia Berhad. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Hi, Michelle, and welcome to the Southeast Asia Travel Show. How are you, and where are you today?
Hi, Gary and Hannah. Good morning. I'm here in KL. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. We're excited to talk to you and see what you've got to say, especially from your Air Asia background too. So let's get started then by looking at your career, Michelle. And it looks like you were born in the Philippines. You studied law there, as well as Singapore, New York. Now you're living and working in Malaysia. Is that right?
Yes, that's perfect. So I'm born in the Philippines. I'm Filipino. And then I studied there in the Philippines first and then took up my master's in Singapore and New York. And yeah, now I live in Malaysia.
Cool. So at what point did you decide then that law, travel and aviation would become your life?
So you have to be very patient. So I promise it will all interweave in a while. But I first, I just got motivated because there wasn't any lawyer in my family except my uncle. So I thought, like, why should I be the first one in my family? In the Philippines, you can't really go straight to law right away. So I had to take my undergraduate, which is political science. And then I worked for a year in a think tank before going to law school. So I think that started my public policy journey. With respect to travel, I fell in love with travel when I moved to Singapore to do my master's in law. Before that, I actually have only flown to Singapore internationally and could probably count on my 10 fingers the number of times I flew domestic in the Philippines. So I think low-cost carriers really made travel possible for struggling graduate students like me at that time. So I just waited for weekend sales and just booked trips to Bangkok, Phuket, even Yangon. So that was my first brush with travel. And I have to say, I really fell in love with it, the ease of flying in and out from Singapore. And then aviation law, believe it or not, I didn't know that such a subject existed until I moved to Singapore to do my master's. I took an elective called aviation law with this wonderful professor named Alan Tan. And I found the subject very fascinating, not only because it was the first time I've heard of it, but I thought his teaching style was super effective. The way he taught the subject, he really made it interesting. So much so that before graduating, I actually wrote a paper on the side on the role of aviation in ASEAN during my spare time and had an opportunity to present it in a conference in Australia. And that started my journey in terms of writing papers on aviation, because I met a PhD student also in NUS in aviation law, and he wanted us to collaborate on a paper together. And I would say that collaboration and partnership is still ongoing until now. So even after I graduated and moved back to working in a financial services sector, I kept writing papers on aviation law on the side during my spare time.
That's interesting. So what point did you, or what made you make the move to New York?
So New York, it was actually part of a dual degree program that I did with Singapore. So at that time, the program was a collaboration between the National University of Singapore and New York University. So I did two masters in 1 year. So I only moved to New York to do my bar exams. So the New York degree, I also took it in Singapore. So it was the New York University professors who flew to Singapore to teach us.
So as a trained lawyer, Michelle, you're admitted to the bar in both the Philippines and New York. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
That's some achievement.
Thanks.
So how did your position as manager of global affairs and policy with Air Asia Group come about?
Yeah, it was actually weird because, as I said earlier, I actually moved back to the financial services sector, right, for work. And after I finished my contract in NUS, because I returned to the university to work as a researcher for their banking and finance research center, AirAsia at that time actually contacted my old professor, Alan Tan, asking for referrals for this new role they just created to help them push the ASEAN single aviation market agenda forward on behalf of the company. And since Professor Alan knew that I wrote this paper on ASEAN aviation, he recommended me. So here I am.
So when was that?
That was way back in 2018.
And has the scope of your role changed in that time?
Oh yeah, definitely. When I first started, so I was just tasked to lead the project on to push the ASEAN single aviation market. But now it has evolved to such a big scope because now I deal with like a variety of policy issues, not just on the airline side of the business for AirAsia. So I also now handle our logistics business, which you know is teleport, up to the financial services, which is BigPay. So my typical day-to-day work now involves monitoring regulatory developments that could affect any of our businesses, and also like devising and implementing lobbying strategies in support of causes that's important to the company.
That sounds super involved. I mean, I imagine you must have to survey lots and lots of countries, presumably every country which AirAsia flies to.
Yeah, I definitely have to be a multitasker. So right now I'm actually like juggling three major projects. So things are very hectic, but I love it. I like being engaged all the time and, you know, not just like expanding my horizons. So aviation is still my first love, but I do like that, you know, I'm given the opportunity to also be involved in the other side of the businesses in AirAsia as well.
So prior to the pandemic, then, were you having to travel a lot? Were you constantly on AirAsia planes?
Oh yes, it's crazy. So my friends actually thought it was a very glamorous job because I would fly at least twice a month until I told them like, you know, there's no business class in AirAsia because we're a local airline. And since, you know, we're not a paying passenger, we actually get the unsold seats. So, you know, like, you know, mostly the unsold seats are the middle seats, right?
Oh, no.
You know, the middle seats. So it's really not glamorous at all. And then before 2020, I was actually based in Manila because I preferred to stay with my family. So it was always a challenge for me to fly to our other markets because everywhere else is just 4 hours away by flight. So there was a point that it really took a toll on my body because I was so exhausted all the time. So that's when, you know, I proposed to my boss that, hey, maybe it's better that, you know, if I am located in Kuala Lumpur instead, because at least like from KL, like I can just, it's only like 2 hours to Jakarta and to Bangkok, and I only have to worry about Manila versus like, you know, me being based in Manila and having to worry about longer flights.
So where was your last business flight?
Oh my God, it's almost a year from now. So my last work trip was in Jakarta in February 2020. But that wasn't my last trip. So 2 weeks before Malaysia declared a lockdown, I was actually in Singapore for a personal trip. So little did I know that it would be the last time I'll travel in a while. I think I would have inserted one more travel if I knew.
So let's talk about aviation policy and law, because it's such a huge topic, Michelle. And it's often remarked that there are no Googles or Amazons of the aviation world, no MNCs, no multinationals in their scope and appeal. Why is that?
So please bear with me. So this stems actually way back, believe it or not, in 1944, right before the end of the Second World War. So the war played a very instrumental role in advancing airplane technology, and 55 countries led by the U.S., we're already thinking about transitioning the vast network of passenger and freight carriage facilities that they built to civilian use at that time. So this led to the negotiation of the Chicago Convention, which basically sets out the core principles which makes possible international air transport to this day. And one of these core principles was that states have sovereignty over its own airspace. So this means that every state is entitled to regulate the entry of foreign aircraft into their own airspace. So, I mean, this was right before the end of the war. So, of course, national security was going to be one of the top concerns for all the countries, most especially like, you know, concerns about the safety of their airspace from enemy airplanes. And to ensure that this will not happen, two things were agreed upon in 1944. So first, they agreed that an airline cannot operate international services to another country if its government does not have an agreement, which we now call a bilateral air services agreement, with the destination country. And second, that the airline has to be substantially owned and effectively controlled by the nationals of that country where the airline is established in. So commonly now, substantial ownership means that, you know, nationals should own at least 51% of an airline. That's the general rule, but we have situation in other countries where it's much stricter. Like, for example, in the Philippines, they actually require Filipinos to own at least 60% of an airline. Or in the US, it's 75%. So it's quite strict. And this restriction, believe it or not, continues to apply to almost all airlines up to this day, save for very, very few exceptions.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's really interesting. So, I mean, commercial aviation is just so complex and so politically charged. Like you said, what are the challenges for you right now in trying to understand different government requirements and standpoints regarding air travel globally and regionally?
So I think now the rules of the game have definitely changed, hopefully temporarily. So now authorities outside the air transportation space get to decide as well whether we can fly or not, such as the Ministry of Health, you know, the National Security Commission, or maybe the COVID-19 task force of the countries. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Of course, it's absolutely vital in a pandemic we're facing right now, but it just makes our jobs harder to do because our stakeholder base has grown so much. So now we have to monitor a lot more things than we used to in the past.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the Philippines, when they restarted travel, what was it, back in May or June, then you had the whole issues of local government units making decisions and the central government making decisions, and that must be really hard to handle.
Yeah, exactly. Like from an operational standpoint, it's really a bit challenging now to plan our network in advance because, you know, like, as you said, like we have situations where, you know, it's not just the national government that imposes restrictions on where we can or we cannot fly. Sometimes it's also local governments have a say, you know, if they will allow travelers into their jurisdiction. Or, you know, what type of testing they will require for these travelers. So it's kind of hard now to plan things a little bit, if I'm being honest with you. So now it's definitely making our jobs more challenging.
From where we're this standpoint that we're at right now, 2021, the beginning of January, I mean, the whole travel landscape has just become so complex and so overlapping. There are so many issues that people didn't really consider before now coming to the fore. And Michelle, you recently contributed to a book called Aviation Law and Policy in Asia, Smart Regulation in Liberalized Markets. And I was reading through some of the abstracts of that yesterday. And, you know, it's a fascinating book because it covers the whole region, Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia as well. So as we look forward from this current point, you know, what are the key issues that are facing the aviation market here in ASEAN and Asia Pacific?
We actually wrote that book way back in 2019, even before the time of COVID. So I guess at the time that we wrote the chapter, one of the main concerns facing the aviation industry was, as I explained earlier, the airline's inability to efficiently expand into the other countries, right? The way that, you know, companies in other industries can, due to the foreign ownership restrictions imposed on airlines that I explained earlier. And I think it's unfortunate to say, but it doesn't look like COVID-19 and the challenges, you know, being faced by airlines right now will do anything to change that whole, you know, ownership regime anytime soon.
So let's have a look at the ASEAN single aviation market now. And you've talked about this a lot in the past. And you said you've written papers on it and things, and it's a really big topic. So ask you question first, what does it mean? What's the single aviation market mean for ASEAN, and what would be the benefit for it, for airlines and for consumers?
Yeah, so I will try to be as simple as possible. So I think in order for me to answer that question, I have to answer it in twofold. So first, what does the ASEAN single aviation market mean right now? And second is, what do you want it to mean in the future? So first, right now, the ASEAN single aviation market is not really, it's still incomplete, I would say. So it has introduced some liberalizing aspects and has brought a lot of growth into the region. So I guess firstly, by allowing countries to designate as many airlines as they want to fly within ASEAN, because previously, most bilateral air service agreements even limit, you know, the carriers or the airlines that can fly from, say, Malaysia. They could limit it to one or just one airline, but now they've opened it up to as many designations as countries want. So that's the first. And then second, the ASEAN agreements also remove the limitations on capacity, frequency, and even aircraft type. So now, for example, Philippine Airlines can actually fly Airbus 380, like, you know, which can carry 500 passengers from Manila to Kuala Lumpur, provided that, you know, KLIA can accommodate such a jumbo plane. So previously, there was even a restriction on that. So the ASEAN single aviation market also lifted restrictions on the aircraft type that you can fly to the routes within ASEAN. And I think lastly, and most importantly, it also opened up what we call the freedom rights, but limited only to the third, fourth, and fifth freedom traffic rights.
That's such a complicated thing, because there are actually 9 freedom rights. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So third and fourth traffic rights actually refer to an airline flying to another country, say a route from Jakarta to Singapore. That's the third freedom for Garuda. And then going back from Singapore to Jakarta is actually the fourth freedom. So that's straightforward enough, right? So that's unlimited flights. And then the fifth freedom is quite more trickier. It involves an airline, say, again, using the example of Garuda, flying to one country, so Jakarta to Singapore, and then flying to another country, say, Singapore to Yangon, before flying back to Jakarta. So that's the fifth freedom, right? And it's now unlimited, only within ASEAN. So airlines can now exercise this free freedom rights, you know, like go to a third country, as long as all the routes are within ASEAN themselves.
I read your paper, Michelle, opening ASEAN skies, the ASEAN way. And this was written a few years ago, but one of the things that you mentioned in there was the fact that opening up ASEAN skies might actually benefit other countries' airlines. And you mentioned China more than it would benefit ASEAN's airlines. Has that been ironed out?
Unfortunately, no. And that's actually key to the second part of my answer, because right now with the current restrictions, right? So the ASEAN single aviation market is just what I explained to you right now. The problem is the ASEAN governments still haven't lifted, you know, the ownership and control restrictions in the different countries. So it means, like, for example, AirAsia in Malaysia can only launch flights from any Malaysian point, from KL or Kota Kinabalu, etc., to any point in China. Whereas, you know, Chinese flights can fly from, you know, any point from China and go to any point in the ASEAN countries. So in terms of, like, you know, having the flexibility or having more points opened up, you can see that Chinese airlines have an advantage in that point, because they can fly to so much more points from their own country to ASEAN compared to ASEAN airlines to China.
And you also mentioned another point. You mentioned financing, which you've talked about before, but the restriction in terms of financing coming from within one country for an airline. But you made a good point that, you know, if you're in some countries of ASEAN, you have limited access to financing, whereas Chinese airlines have huge access to financing. And so it's kind of imbalanced playing field in that sense.
Yeah, because, you know, the majority requirement or having an ownership requirement is very limiting. Like, you know, if you require foreign investors to only own, say, 49% or 40% of an airline, that's really not enough, right? Especially, for example, if the domestic capital markets of a particular country cannot or are not able to raise capital to pay for 51% of the equity of an airline. So that actually limits the development of airlines in the domestic markets here in ASEAN. Just to give you guys an example, so region that we always compare ourselves to in terms of this aviation market is the EU. And there they have a more solid single aviation market, whereas they have lifted the ownership and control restrictions already. So there we can see, like, you know, airline subsidiaries popping up around the EU. Just an example, like, you know, Lufthansa, a German airline, they actually also own subsidiary airlines in other countries in the EU, such as Swiss Air in Switzerland, Brussels Airlines in Belgium, etc. And that is simply not possible in ASEAN today.
Yeah, you mentioned again in your paper that one of the reasons for that is that the EU has these supranational institutions like the European Court of Justice, the European Commission, the European Parliament, which ASEAN doesn't have. And I think you said in your paper probably never will have.
Yeah, and that's absolutely correct. So, even before the EU got to this point, right, of course, a lot of countries resisted at first. But since they have this, like, supranational authorities, as you mentioned, they were able to impose or require the countries to abide by the single aviation market agenda. Whereas here in ASEAN, we have the ASEAN Secretariat, which doesn't have supranational powers. In fact, it's a secretariat, so it's just meant to, you know, make sure that the house is in order. But they cannot actually require ASEAN member states to go further than what we have right now.
So let's leave the aviation single market aside, and let's just look generally then at the outlook for aviation in 2021. What do you think? Are we going to see travel bubbles coming? Are we going to see an ASEAN travel bubble coming? How do you think this is going to play out this year? Big question, I know.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been talking to this with our teams a lot, because obviously this is our big concern of ours as well. And I think now the uphill challenge is first to get governments comfortable with travel again, full stop, even domestically. Because even in Southeast Asia, as we know, domestic travel and tourism remains a challenge in some countries. Like, for example, here in Malaysia, where, you know, MCO 2.0 is extended until Feb 18, interstate travel will not be possible until then, until the end of the MCO, hopefully. And also in the Philippines, where, as we mentioned earlier, different local governments have different requirements for tourists, and it's only to limited destinations even. So we think that will be the first priority of governments to establish some normalcy within their borders first, even before they can be comfortable with opening up for general travel again. And in terms of travel bubbles, we're quite optimistic that in between those periods, like, travel bubble negotiations will still continue to be in play, especially for business and essential travel. So you mentioned earlier the ASEAN travel bubble, right? So right now, as it is being conceived, they're actually only meant to cover business and essential travel, although we would want it to be extended to, you know, some form of leisure travel bubbles as well, maybe perhaps to starting with naturally isolated places first, like, you know, similar to what Maldives is currently doing right now.
That brings us to the big debate in travel right now, which is vaccinations. And you recently posted on LinkedIn about the case of aircrew being considered for early vaccination. And this refers to Cathay Pacific in Hong Kong, where the Hong Kong government was considering making aircrew from long-haul destinations undergo a quarantine. So do you think that the airline sector will lobby for this, for aircrew to be considered as frontline workers?
As early as last year, I think December 2020, we have already seen the aviation sector lobbying for this, particularly or primarily through industry organizations like IATA and ACI. I was just looking yesterday that even in the US, there's a strong lobby led by flight attendants and pilot unions for them to be considered as essential workers as well. So yeah, I hope that, you know, the issue would gain more traction and governments around here in ASEAN would start considering aircrew and, you know, our ground staff as priority workers as well for vaccination.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. We've certainly seen that in Singapore, haven't we, with the government saying that they want to position Singapore Airlines to be one of the first airlines that have been vaccinated. So hopefully some other Southeast Asian governments kind of take inspiration from that, I suppose. So another question then linked to vaccination, and this is probably even more controversial. You know, of course, Qantas came out last year and said, you know, maybe an later on, all of their international passengers will have to be vaccinated. Do you think that that's going to happen?
Yeah, you know, quite interestingly, I was actually watching Alan Joyce's interview, the CEO of Qantas. He had an interview with Eurocontrol last night. And he was asked again the same question, and he still maintains that, you know, he would require passengers to be vaccinated before traveling on Qantas. Whereas I think for AirAsia, for example, Tony was also asked this question, the same question last year. And he said that, you know, it's not really up to the airlines to decide. So, you know, it's up to the governments, of course, to decide, you know, as an airline, we just abide by whatever regulatory requirements that the governments will impose on us.
Yeah, that's a good point. I saw Alan Joyce interviewed by Reuters, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, and he said the same thing, more or less. He said that they would, if it was their choice, Qantas would require people to be vaccinated. But he thought that Australia would actually make that a requirement anyway. So like you said, it kind of takes it out of the airline's hands.
So do you think, Michelle, that ASEAN governments should be a bit more like Singapore in terms of, you know, Singapore is pretty aggressive in terms of pursuing green lanes and fast track travel arrangements. Do you think other ASEAN governments should follow something similar?
Yeah, definitely. Although I think, you know, most ASEAN countries would hate to be, you know, would hate to use Singapore as a benchmark. But I think, like, it's true. I think we really have to start, or they have to start somewhere, you know. And, you know, the green lane or the fast track travel arrangements pursued by Singapore has already shown that, you know, there are enough safeguards under, you know, this type of arrangements to ensure that travelers who enter the country are COVID-free or detected right away through, like, you know, on-arrival testing. And as we have seen also last weekend, we're in Singapore suspended the RGL with three countries because of, you know, high number of cases in the counterpart countries. We can see that, you know, mechanisms are actually in place to put like a stop or like maybe a circuit breaker, if you will, to this type of arrangements in cases of surge, you know, in case of a surge in cases. But that doesn't mean that, you know, negotiations don't or yet cannot resume right now, or like, you know, such travel arrangements cannot be started right away, right?
Yeah, I just want to go back to one of the points you mentioned earlier, Michelle. You were saying, you know, getting governments to reopen not just borders but domestic travel is an issue. And as you said, here in Malaysia, we have the MCO is extended again for another 2 weeks. So there's this sort of trade-off, isn't there? There's this prevention of domestic travel, but there's also border closures as well. The longer this goes on, the more entrenched government positions tend to become.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, my personal fear is, you know, the longer the borders or travel will not be allowed, you know, the harder it will be to gain back passengers' confidence to fly again. So now it's not just, you know, on top of the concerns of safety, which we try to address, you know, by saying, like, you know, air travel is one of the safest forms of travel, but also in terms of, like, you know, they don't have confidence that, you know, the government will not just impose restrictions overnight. So those are the things that are, I guess, battling against us right now as well. So I think the longer, you know, this goes on, the harder it will be to regain the passengers' confidence right away. Although I do believe in revenge travel. And I think I'll be one of those people who get on the plane as soon as tomorrow if they open the borders again.
So where will you go first then, internationally, when they reopen borders?
So please don't laugh at me, but I actually want to go back to the Philippines. Not just to visit my family, but I just want to go to the beach. I would give anything to take a nap on the beach right now in one of the beautiful islands in Palawan.
And Michelle, this has been a great chat, and we could continue talking about this for hours and hours. It's such a complex and fascinating subject. But before we go, we mentioned your book earlier, Aviation Law and Policy in Asia, Smart Regulation in Liberalized Markets. And I think later this week you're involved in a webinar. Is that can you tell us a little bit about that?
So yeah, good thing that you mentioned it. Actually, this Friday we'll be presenting two chapters from that book. Smart Regulation in Liberalized Markets. So I will be presenting together with my colleague, Ms. Laline. She is a professor from Thammasat University. So we'll be presenting our chapters. So I'll be talking about the efforts of the Philippines to lift the ownership restrictions in airlines in the Philippines. And Professor Lalin will talk about, you know, the effects of liberalization in the Thailand domestic aviation market. So if you want to register, it's Friday, February 5 at 9 a.m. Hong Kong and KL time. You can just Google or you can go to the website of the University of Victoria in Canada and just search for smart regulation and liberalized markets. So the registration is still open, and I'm happy to say we have 100 plus registrants already. So I'm quite excited.
Yeah, fantastic. It should be a really good event, I think. So yeah, listeners, go and tune in and listen to more of what Michelle has to say. So thank you so much, Michelle, for taking the time to speak with Gary and I today. We really appreciate it.
Yes, it was a pleasure talking to you guys. Thanks for letting me share, you know, more about aviation law here in ASEAN and how it works.
So that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed with Michelle or what we missed out. You can drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
So that's a wrap for this week, and we look forward to talking more Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, Michelle.
Thanks, guys.